Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:47 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is March 27th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. But it's also the end of the quarter. So we've got two important events that have transpired. The first is that generally at the end of the quarter, there is a pop in demand for liquidity. That's not going to be a problem right now, considering the quantity of money that has been thrown at the repo market. Let's just bear in mind that the Federal Reserve has made $500 billion available on three different maturities. So that's in excess of, well, it's in the region at least, of $1.5 trillion of potential liquidity. Of course, it hasn't been drawn down, that quantity, but certainly that's what's available. Then, of course, we also have the point that money managers are going to be looking at the end of their quarter, and they're probably going to want to do some reweighting. Everything has pulled back. It's going to be a rare money manager that put in a positive performance this quarter. We've had a meaningful rebound this week, though, so it's not looking as bad as it did last week. Now, the big question is, what happens next? Well, the first thing that's important, I think, about the NASDAQ is that it had pulled back violently, there's no doubt about that, but it found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and it just about squeaked out an upside weekly key reversal in here this week. Markets did sell off in the last half hour of trading, and that is pretty consistent with what we see from ETF reweightings. They're probably starting to get that in ahead of the weekend. Nobody knows what's going to happen over the weekend. And in much the same way that shorts don't want to have big leveraged positions on heading into the weekend, leveraged longs aren't going to want to have a heavy long heading into the weekend either, for the simple reason they just do not know what is going to happen over the weekend. And there is one potential possibility I'll discuss in a moment about what could happen this weekend, and it should give perhaps investors at least some pause. Now, one thing that we do know is the quantity of money that has been printed internationally is beyond comparison, and we are now in a period of synchronized global monetary and fiscal stimulus. The Federal Reserve has embarked upon a new quantitative easing program. And rather than simply looking at individual charts, let's just look at the total for central bank balance sheets. It surged by over $1 trillion in the last week, and it is now at a new all-time high of $21.3 trillion. So that is a very meaningful change. It is up, in fact, almost $2 trillion since February. And it is very clearly now at a new all-time high. But perhaps the more important point is that the speed of the advance that we've seen has only got one comparison previously. And that is all the way back in 2008, when in very short order, they took the size of the balance sheet up from just under 7 to just under 10 trillion. So added $3 trillion to the size of the balance sheet in the space of about 3 months. I think it is quite likely we're going to see a similar move now in terms of global central banks. The Federal Reserve bought about $600 billion worth of bonds in here this week. They announced towards the close in here today that they are going to reduce those purchases down to about $60 billion next week. So they think that they have got a handle on the panicky environment, and I think they've got good reason for thinking that. One thing that I thought is particularly interesting is the extent of the pullback we've seen in what might be considered to be quality stocks. The S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats ETF pulled back from 75 to 50, so approximately a third of a discount. And now we see that there is at least some evidence of support coming through, where it has rallied just over about 10% off the lows since earlier this week. But what I think is particularly relevant is to look at these companies which have never cut their dividend or haven't cut dividends in decades. The fact that Coca-Cola can go from 60 to 30 and change in the space of 3 weeks is rather spectacular. When we look at the fact that the yield on the share got up as high as 4% and is currently sitting around 3.75%, and that is the highest yield on Coca-Cola we've seen since 1985. And the more of these dividend aristocrat kind of companies that we look at, then we can see that they have seen their yields contract over the course of this week, and they're now pretty much in the region of the places where these shares have found support over the course of the last decade. The more of them that we look at, then the more of that we get. I'm just trying to remember Cisco's. There we go, SYY. These are the very significant upticks in yield that we've seen. And these are for companies that generally have got very strong balance sheets, that they have got the wherewithal to continue to increase dividends come what may. One thing that I found particularly interesting in here this week was the fact that we've had companies certainly cancelling their dividends. And I think that was particularly relevant for companies like Ford. But the number of companies that have in fact cancelled dividends over the course of the last decade is zero. And we've had five companies in the S&P 500 cancel their dividend this year. Back in 2009, the number was six. So this tells us that cancelling dividends for companies in the S&P 500 that don't normally do so is quite rare. Now, obviously, we've got companies like Ford that have got existential crises, and this is not new news. The share has been trending down for more than 5 years, and we've certainly had an acceleration on the downside. When we look at the valuation, the estimated PE is up to 20. It was closer to 5 last week. So there has been a lot of bad news started to be priced into the potential earnings of the share in future. The issue with the coronavirus is only secondary to the kinds of challenges that these companies have over the longer term. The fact that large numbers of airlines have been spending all of their free cash flow on buybacks. They've been issuing debt to fund buybacks, and that has left them denuded of capital for a crisis like the one that has just emerged. So these are obviously not going to be the companies that lead us up and out of the crisis. What is more likely is that companies that can sustain their dividend, particularly against a background where 10-year treasuries have contracted in their yield substantially, are now around the 67 basis point level. That at least tells me that certainly there is still demand for some form of safe haven. The compression in yields that we're getting is also because people are worried and looking at the size of the stimulus package and how much the government and central bank are going to be both printing and buying. Eventually, that is going to create an equilibrium, a point in the fixed income markets. But when we look at the relative valuation of the S&P 500's yield compared to that on the 10-year treasury, it's still wider than 150 basis points. And this is pretty extraordinary in terms of the discount that equities are trading at relative to bonds, or vice versa, the premium that that bonds are trading at relative to equities. And this is not a condition that is individual to the USA. I created this spread chart in here today. It's for the FTSE 100 and 10-year gilts, and it's exactly the same, except for the fact that instead of talking about 1.5% of a differential, we're talking about over 6%. Well, part of the reason why the spread is so much wider in the UK than it is for the USA is because of the FTSE 100's weightings, which are heavily influenced by both banks and energy companies. Royal Dutch Shell, with the A and B shares combined, representing about 7% of the index, and BP another 4.3. So let's just round it out and say 15% of the index is dominated by two big energy companies. And these energy companies have got very large dividend yields. The yield on Royal Dutch Shell right now is 11.83%. And oil prices have contracted really very substantially. Now, Brent crude today fell by an additional $1.4. It's down to 25, or just a shade under that, having been at 70 at the beginning of January. And when we look at that on a long-term basis, it's been a really quite lengthy time since we've seen prices at these levels. It is inevitable that we're going to have some form of bankruptcy in the energy sector before prices start going back up. When we look at the high-yield energy spreads, then they are at 200 basis, excuse me, they're at 2,000 basis points, and this is spread over treasuries. And the level that's at today is well in excess of where they traded at back in 2008 or 2016, and that represents acute financial risk for the high yield sector. Russia and China, or excuse me, Russia and Saudi Arabia are in a price war for the oil market, and they're trying to capture the most possible market share that they possibly can. China, being the biggest importer, is trying its best to import less. The USA, having become an exporter, it had once been the biggest importer. So the status quo in the energy market has completely changed around. And that is only when we begin to just think about the influence of hydraulic fracturing and unconventional supply. On top of all of that, you have the birth of renewables, the increasing competitiveness of renewables, and the fact that battery technology is improving at a rapid pace. We're not there yet in terms of the ultimate battery, that the battery that can deliver a car that, under any circumstances, is going to be more competitive than an internal combustion engine. But we are going to get there, and when we do, it is going to represent an existential threat to the global dominance of oil as the premier energy commodity. Now, there are some very important long-term considerations for thinking about when it comes to these big changes in the market. But the near term, one thing we can be assured of is that the energy markets are going to be volatile, because for the longest time, supply has been the volatile characteristic and demand has been a constant. So when looking at supply and demand in the energy markets in particular, a pretty steady growth trajectory in terms of demand was always the base assumption, and supply varied around that base assumption. Today, we have a different scenario because the demand constant has changed. The evolution of renewables changes the assumptions about demand for oil, not necessarily about net energy, but certainly for the demand for oil. We're potentially at peak car demand in China. The size of the population relative to the size of the country and the congestion that they already have on the roads suggests that they're unlikely to be able to put more cars on the road. India might have a growth trajectory, but the size of the country is smaller than China and the population is larger. So it's unlikely that you're going to ever reach the same number of cars owned per person as you do, for example, in other countries. On a per capita basis, the USA might have cheaper oil, but as a result, they drive further than anyone in Europe does. And Europe might have more expensive oil, but they drive less. Well, in China, they'll be driving less, they'll own less cars. So the assumption that we're going to continue to have a steady growth trajectory in terms of demand, is very questionable when you add renewables into that mix. And the incentive for large population consuming countries to become energy independent, then the march of renewables is inevitable. Once the technological milestone is reached of either a solid state battery or a silicon anode battery or a polymer battery or an aluminium battery for power generation, I guess, optimize the production from the conventional power plants. All of these are potential solutions. The quantity of money that is flowing into this sector is increasing all the time because the size of the prize is really beyond comparison. Now, that means that we are going to have a much more volatile competitive environment because instead of the demand pie getting progressively larger, it's getting smaller. And at the very minimum, it has stopped growing. And if it has stopped growing, it means that competition for parts of that pie is only going to intensify. And the USA is now a serious competitor in terms of that pie. Now, what was particularly interesting in here this week was that the State Department said that Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela is a drug dealer and put a $60 million price on his head. That is very similar to what they did with Noriega. And if that is going to be followed to its logical conclusion, we are potentially on the point where the USA is going to invade Venezuela. And oil prices are on their lows. We have a number of the major energy producing companies have collapsed in value over the course of the last while. We've had a pretty impressive rebound in some, like Chevron. ExxonMobil got to a yield earlier on this week of over 10%. It's currently at 9.42%. Royal Dutch Shell is at 11%. These are extraordinary yields, even if they are halved. And Exxon has never cut its dividend. But even if they are halved, they're still going to yield in the region of 5%. And that is still competitive with what we see from government bonds. So there is certainly value appearing in the equity markets, but particularly in companies that have got long histories of rewarding investors with dividends. So we are potentially going to be looking at a period in time where there is a great deal of volatility in the energy markets, and the potential for conflagration, for war, in any way you want to describe it, to either influence the energy market, secure the energy market, break up the pie of where demand comes from or is realized, or supply. These are all parts of the equation that are going to be experimented on. But the bigger picture here is that the human condition relies on a number of different factors for survival and to thrive. The first is food. Well, food is still an incredibly important part of the economy, but we have largely solved for food. Even though the supermarkets have optimized their supply chains to such an extent that they haven't been able to respond quickly to the surge in demand for food in response to the coronavirus, nonetheless, there is no shortage of food. And when we look at the continuous commodity index, which is unweighted, then it has not traded at the levels it is trading at right now for a very prolonged period of time, going all the way down to the lows in 2008 or all the way back to 2005. When we look at grain and bean prices, soybeans is still very much in a range. Corn is also ranging. The one of the food commodities that is, in fact, does have got clear basic characteristics is rough rice, that it is now looking increasingly likely that it has completed its base formation. And wheat has also got base formation characteristics. It hasn't quite completed it yet, but we're starting to see some activity in these food commodities right now. But they're going to be short-term in nature. And once we get a harvest in, then those prices are likely to come back down. As a species, we have largely solved for food. And until quite recently, we had not yet solved for energy. And energy was still very much dependent on a country just being lucky that it played host to resources. And that is now ending. If we're getting to a point where renewables are largely competitive with fossil fuels, then the lucky happenstance of a country prospering simply because it plays host to energy resources is likely to end. Now, in much the same way that some countries have got very highly productive agricultural land and still do okay, then there will be also countries that produce energy assets at such an incredibly low price that they will still do okay. But it is also worth reminding ourselves that when the global economy was wholly dependent on agriculture and physical labor and the fact that it was not possible to massively increase production without a corresponding increase in the population, then gold was a really quite appropriate way to peg the economic valuations in terms of the financial system. That did start to come under pressure with the Industrial Revolution and the massive increase in productive capacity with automation and replaceable parts evolution, the fact that people could make machines with machines, all of these factors helped to create an environment where the reliance on gold started to deteriorate, and oil was then relied upon as the foundation for economic activity. And it also then helped to create an environment where that oil was in many respects a currency, and that currencies were referred to as petrocurrencies. So that has been a large part of the foundation of our economic system and our financial system for most of the last 50, if not 60 years. Well, we can now see that there is evidence that that system is breaking down. On the one hand, it's because energy is no longer representative of the growth potential in the economy. And that's particularly true of the more advanced economies where the evolution of the services sector has taken off. So the way I tend to think about it is that humanity solved for food. Now we are currently in the process of solving for energy. And those are two massive human needs. They are going to always be essential. And there will be periods of volatility. There will be times when they go through significant bull and bear market cycles. That's unlikely to ever change. But we now have a different basis upon which to value economic activity. And that, I think, is where the evolution of the economic cycle is likely to take us. There are a number of things that are pointing in that direction. One is the volatility of the energy market and the fact that the demand curve is no longer rising. Then there's the debt cycle, and we have had a massive move in terms of debt, and it is not over. The 10-year total return index has broken significantly on the upside, and it remains in an uptrend. And it has been in an uptrend since 1983. And I only say 1983 because that's when the index started. Probably the bull market started in 1980. Well, we have people that are looking at the long term and looking at history and thinking about how is this all going to end? What happens when longer dated bonds get to a zero bound? And not just in the USA, but in other countries too. And that obviously is a significant question. Now, the USA has said that they're not going to move into negative deposit rates. But when we look at the charts, and we've had such incredible dynamic action over the course of the last couple of weeks, you do have to zoom in to see the individual candles. But this kind of extraordinary volatility is obviously representative of deflationary forces. The coronavirus is obviously a significant economic challenge, but it's a short-term challenge. There are obviously going to be repercussions. We've already seen that thousands of people can die in response to it. There's much less discussion about whether those people would have died anyway, and how sick were a lot of the people who have contracted the disease before they contracted it. So those are determinations that are not politically sensitive. People don't want to ask those questions. But one thing we know is that regardless of how bad the news is going to get over the course of the next 3 weeks, and it is going to get pretty grisly, we have not yet seen the peak in the infection growth rate in the UK or in the USA or in a number of the emerging markets or in Latin America or in Australia yet. So that is still ahead of us. And we're not going to see the end of the breakout until we see not only the peak in the growth rate, but the peak in the infection rate and the subsequent decline coming through. Well, when we even look at what is going on in Italy right now, then it is following the trajectory of the model really quite accurately. And the reason that I look at Italy is because Italy, more than any country, has got a clear incentive to give an accurate count of infections, because the level of assistance that is provided to Italy from the rest of the EU is going to be heavily influenced by how bad the situation in fact is. And we can see that the peak in the infection rate has already been seen. Now, that does not mean that the peak in the death rate has been seen, because we can anticipate that even as the growth rate in new infections decreases, the death rate will continue to increase. And that's a positive development. This is something that tells us that Italy, despite how bad it has been there, is coming out the other end of this problem. Spain is probably reasonably close, but the UK, the USA, and a number of other countries have not yet got there. And China has now closed its borders as of tonight because they don't want any more people to bring it back from overseas and risk spreading it once more in their economy. They have got factories back up to about 75% of their capacity, but now they don't have any demand. That's almost exactly the same kind of condition that Mrs. Tracy's business was in. 6 or 7 weeks ago, we were worried about running out of inventory. That isn't a problem anymore because there's no demand. And these are some of the challenges that large numbers of businesses are facing. A good friend of mine owns a garment factory producing fast fashion, and he has had to leave all his workers go. He is conserving cash, looks at the stock market, said he wish he could buy some of the better value out there, but just simply cannot do it because he's got to conserve cash. He still has to pay his property taxes, still has to pay for utilities, still has to pay for the upkeep, but not, there's absolutely no money coming in. Can't apply for a small business loan because with no orders and no business, there is no way to generate any income. So why, how on earth could they hold on to their employees? Well, joblessness soared in here this week. This is a reasonably useful barometer. And joblessness in the USA went up by 3.28 million last week. And it's quite likely it's going to be a similar figure next week. So that is likely to take the unemployment rate up in excess of 10% in the USA over the course of the next month or two. And then it will start to get better. The coronavirus is going to leave a scar on economic activity for probably anything up to 2 or 3 quarters. But the quantity of money that's being printed and the range of activities that are being deployed by the central bank are epic in scale everywhere, whether that is true of the USA, of the UK, of Europe, of Japan, Switzerland. All of these countries and regions are embarking on massive fiscal stimulus, massive monetary stimulus, all in service to try and avoid a depression, and they will be successful. They'll be successful because it's a simple fact. They're going to keep printing money until they're successful. So when we go back and think about the breakout we've just seen on the total assets of central banks chart, that it is now up to 21 trillion dollars, then it is quite logical that it is going to reach more like 30 trillion on aggregate before we get to the end of this crisis. And when we look at the downward pressure on yields, the quantity of money that is being printed, and then the sources of outperformance that we're seeing in the market, well, consumer staples sectors are doing well. And anything that can be enjoyed at home is also doing well. That's certainly true of someone's phone. And Apple has bounced from the region of the upper side of its underlying trading range, or its old high. And this is not the first time it's done that. So there have certainly been occasions on the in the past where Apple has bounced from a previous peak. It is doing that again. This is its primary trend consistency. The other one is that when it becomes wildly overextended relative to the trend mean, it is going to pull back and quite likely pull back below it. And it has just done that as well. When we think about what we can anticipate from markets generally, we've had a massive type 2 top formation. We have the failed upside break, the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. After a massive pullback like that, people start to look around and think, what has really changed? Certainly, we know that there was a problem, and now the big question is, what's that likely to mean in terms of the future rather than the present? Maybe this is a buying opportunity. So some people will look at it as another buy the dips outcome, that we've had plenty of chances to buy the dip over the last decade. Every one of them has been a good opportunity to buy, so we should buy. Then there are going to be the emergency investment committee meetings. I've sat on a few of them. I've got another one on Monday. I am pretty sure that and everyone I've been on so far, there has been somebody who has been of the opinion that it's time to buy the dip, that there's value out there. There is also somebody who says, I think that we need to be way more conservative and put money in money market funds and in highly liquid instruments. And the general consensus is we're going to wait and see. We're going to see what happens. And that waiting and seeing what happens removes a source of demand from the market. And then there are going to be the people who think, well, golly, I really wish I had sold when the market was trading around 3,000. I promised myself in 2018 that if it ever got back to 3,000, I would sell, and I didn't do it, and I felt like a rock star for about 3 months, and now I feel like a fool. So they're going to be looking for the opportunity to sell into a rally. There is the additional argument that we have just seen an epic-sized advance in the quantity of money being printed. And the defining characteristic of the bull market over the last decade has been liquidity. So, with this massive increase in liquidity, then that should help to inflate asset prices. The downside from that is that a number of companies have shelved their buyback plans, and buybacks have been the primary source of new demand in this market. And if the market is going to not only rebound, but subsequently sustain a move back above 3,000 and reassert the medium-term advance, then we're going to have to see a new source of demand emerge if buybacks are not going to come back and occupy that level. So when we take all of those factors into consideration, we would have to think that it is likely we see a range. And I think it is likely that that range is going to form probably between the 1,000-day moving average, which is the red line on this chart, and the 200-day moving average, which is the green line. And subsequently, if we get upside follow-through next week, and that, of course, is an open question, but I think it's likely, then we should then see a range forming. It is, I think, worth highlighting, though, that there is a bearish potential, and that we do need to consider what the bearish potential is. That this is a type 2 top, that the market has pulled back below the 1,000-day moving average, and it encountered resistance there in the last half hour of trading today. If it fails here and ranges below the 1,000-day moving average and subsequently breaks down, well, then we're talking about a completed top formation and a first step below the top. So the extent to which the massive monetary and fiscal accommodation can support markets will have to be given some evidence. But the simple bet is that the companies that have had to rely on issuing debt to fund their buyback programs, they're the most likely to have to cancel their buyback programs. The companies that have been increasing their dividends for upwards of 40 years, with never a year where they've cut their dividend, they are probably most likely to be able to continue to pay their dividends. And against a background where there is continued downward pressure on government bond yields, the potential to now pick up attractive yields in the equity markets, it is something that is clearly one of the more attractive qualities for the market. It is also worth considering that a number of the technology companies don't buy back their shares. A number of them also don't pay dividends. So they're incredibly cash rich. They could institute a dividend, or they could decide to continue to buy back their shares. Of course, companies like Google and Facebook are heavily reliant on advertising revenue, and in a bear market and a contracting balance sheet environment, some companies would cut back on their advertising. Google is now at least steady in the region of $1,000, but it absolutely needs to hold that level. Facebook might have a hit virtual reality product on the books, but it means nothing to their balance sheet, and advertising here also represents all of revenue. Amazon's profit comes from its cloud business, and it has been really quite steady because of its retail business. But it doesn't make any money from the retail business, and it is downgrading sales for a substantial number of third-party sellers. It's no longer giving them placement for their products because it is prioritizing emergency supplies, whether those are groceries or in the healthcare sector. Well, that is something that is potentially going to impact its earnings over the course of the next while. And then, of course, they have the potential that the infection rate inside their warehouses is going to increase. And that also represents a challenge. So the big point, of course, is that the bigger companies have been able to draw on capital. And the bigger private equity companies will be drawing on their investors and drawing on their revolving credit facilities. Some of those private equity companies are going to be investing in the hospitality sector because there are going to be big hotels on sale and people are not going to stop going on holiday indefinitely. So, and they're not going to stop traveling for business indefinitely. So that does represent a potential bargain opportunity for some of the more than $2 trillion in dry powder available to the private equity sector. They are also going to be looking at some of the renewables. This is Suncor, which is an oil company and a rather high-priced one at that. I'm not doing this particularly effectively. I'm looking for Sunrun. There we go. So Sunrun is the kind of company that locks in long-term cash flows, and it depends on access to liquidity. So as long as there is plenty of liquidity available, then it should be fine. But of course, it is wholly dependent on access to that liquidity. And it is logical that homeowners would want to do anything to try and contain their utility costs in a bear market. So that should potentially be beneficial for these kinds of renewable energy infrastructure type investments. When, for example, we look at the geothermal sector, then Ormat Technologies as a utility is also in the kind of position that should be beneficial for investment in renewables. So that's also likely to be a source of new investment from private equity, and they will certainly be looking for value opportunities out here at present. Now, the bigger question is how much of a hit is the global economy going to take beyond the short term from the coronavirus? One of the more encouraging points is that lockdowns have contributed to the infection rate moderating, and that is allowing medical facilities the time to start to boost the availability of respirators and ventilators so they can treat people. It's the fact that the healthcare sectors have not been prepared and have then been inundated with patients has contributed to the high death rate. So it's reasonable to assume that if they did have the resources, the death rate would have been milder and there would have been no need to have the lockdowns. We can then conclude that infrastructure will be created to ensure that in the event that we get these kinds of pandemics again, that we will have a swifter response. So that's a potential positive outcome. One thing that is also worth considering is that immunity through antibodies to the common cold, which is another coronavirus, often don't last more than a year. So even immunity to the current coronavirus can degrade over time. Then the access to a form of vaccine is obviously going to be one of the greatest priorities. But that is one of the great things about technological innovation. And I do think that it is worth just coming back around to this question, when we consider where the future lies. The pace of technological innovation is in the knee of an exponential curve. The massive quantity of data that is being created on a daily basis is beyond the estimates of anyone over the course of the last 20 years. The computing power that is being created to parse that data, to come up with answers to questions we haven't even asked, is also something that is on an exponential growth curve. The fact that supercomputers are being devoted now to looking for treatments to the coronavirus and have come up with more than 90 potential solutions from existing medications is something that is, I think, less reported on, but really very encouraging. The pace of innovation in quantum computing is improving all the time. The pace of innovation in fusion energy is improving all the time. Well, that also helps to ram home the point that we're increasingly getting towards a point where we as a species have solved for energy. And as a species, we may have challenges, but we are solving for food. Well, now the question is, if those are the solved problems which had previously been the basis for economic activity and value, then if data is now where the greatest economic activity growth phase is, then it is likely to become the basis for economic activity for perhaps the next 100 years. And that is likely to then contribute to a new economic system. Well, the value that can be derived from the data system is going to be a multiple of how big one's population is, how productive the population is. So then you need a great education system. You need those people to be very creative and productive. So freedom of expression is an important one. They need to have access to liquidity. Well, we know how to solve for that. It's then there has been a massive increase in the quantity of money being printed. Culture is obviously going to be another factor. There is the work ethic element of that, and the willingness to give people the tools necessary to achieve their productive capacity. I think it is underappreciated how much organized labor tends to inhibit the expansion of technology within the workforce. The very simple fact that countries like Germany and South Korea are among the most automated and still among the biggest powerhouses of manufacturing, whereas those that have got more organized labor, which have protected the so-called rights of workers over the productivity gains from automation, have seen their manufacturing sectors denuded. Well, certainly the UK and the USA fall into that category. And therefore, it's going to be a very complicated way of looking at markets because of these competing forces. China obviously has got the big population, and they are investing heavily in education, but they've got a long way to go. At the same time, individual freedoms and capacity for creativity is heavily influenced by the authoritarian regime, so that is an inhibiting factor. But I think one thing that we can conclude is, in order to prosper in an economic environment which is predicated on the value of data and its utility, then you need to have some of these characteristics. If you do not have a large population, and you do not have a great education system, or freedom of expression, or access to liquidity, or a work ethic, well, it's going to be very hard for a country to prosper. And that, I think, is already evident in the global economy. When we look around the world, it is the most innovative countries are prospering. Those that have got a heavy reliance on commodities and commodities only have had some significant challenges. The volatility that we have now in commodities is also a factor of the relatively less important position that they occupy in the global economy. Now, I think it is worth considering these questions now because of the massive response that we've had to the coronavirus. We know what is likely to happen in terms of the monetary response and the fiscal response because we've seen it before. The response is no different. It's simply the magnitude of the response which has changed. The big question, however, is what's going to happen when we run into problems with debt? And the fact that yields are so incredibly low is robbing savers. This does bring us to the important point about gold, because gold prices have broken on the upside. Because of the monetary response that we've had from the authorities, then we are in a phase now of modern monetary theory. Now, this is potentially going to go very bad, or it could potentially go very good. And I'm very much reminded of the benign dictator from Machiavelli. The benign dictator is someone who will help to stoke economic activity and will not be too self-interested. However, we can rely on politicians to aspire to that ideal and fail. So we get vanity projects, we get graft coming in, and what we have essentially seen is the privatization of public markets. And that means that the quantity of money that's going to be printed is beyond the imagination of anybody 10 years ago. Today, when we throw around the topic of $20 billion, it is done so with no consideration for just how much money that is, or the fact that it is likely to increase by another 50% in the next few years is also rather incredible. But the most important thing here is that while we have volatility in individual currencies, and of course the value of those currencies is going to be very much tied to the productive capacity of the domestic populations, and obviously that is now under pressure in the short term, but it is likely to recover in the long term. But the obvious response is that they are quickly devaluing their currencies to deal with the problem that is right in front of us, that the massive quantity of debt that has built up over the last 40 years is very much tied to the economic basis in agriculture, gold, and in, well, obviously no longer in gold, but oil, and the infrastructure required to get that into the market and active. It is less influenced by the technology sector, but the dollar failed to sustain the move above 100 again. The size of the downward dynamic is at least as large as the size of the breakout. It suggests, therefore, that we are likely to see it coming back down towards the 90 level. And gold prices are appreciating in just about every currency. So they rallied in a dynamic manner in here this week and are now trading around $1,600. This is a volatile environment, but it was a very impressive breakout from a six-year base formation in the middle of last year, and now prices are continuing to rise. There is no reason to believe that they're not going to exceed the peak put in 2011. And this is, of course, only in US dollars. In Australian dollars, we've already had an acceleration and we're due some consolidation. In Brazilian real, it's still pushing on the upside. When we look at some of the biggest gold consumers against the Chinese renminbi, it is pressuring the peak from back in 2011. Against the Indian rupee, it is also pressuring its all-time peak from just 3 weeks ago. Gold is the barometer against which all fiat currencies are measured. We simply do not have a data measure against which to measure those currencies. We're simply nowhere near that kind of stability in the market that could lend to us. I do think that's probably out there somewhere in the future. The closest thing to a digital barometer we have is Bitcoin, and that is, I would say, a very imperfect measure. In fact, Bitcoin does not have the supply elasticity that would be required to cater to an exponential growth model in the data sector, and therefore it is not appropriate for a currency basis that we could think about in future. But it is an asset of limited supply, and supply inelasticity meets rising demand is always going to have an impact on markets. I think the most important point is that the monetary response that we've had pretty much means that modern monetary theory is now the reality. We're going to have massive fiscal deficits. At the moment, at least, they are helping to support people and support people's ability to prosper and to conduct their lives. But the moral hazard that has been introduced into the market in order to cater to the uncertainty from the coronavirus is something that I think has not been fully appreciated. if the government will pay your mortgage, pay your pension, pay your national insurance, or your health, or your social security, then it removes a lot of the incentive for working. And when they start to compensate self-employed people, then the rationale for hard work has to be questioned. Now, obviously, these are very extraordinary measures, but they do open the door to people starting to rely heavily on government largesse. And that's not something that is going to persist indefinitely. Eventually, if people's productivity does not improve, then we are going to have a debt problem. And we're already seeing that the continued strength in gold is hedging against that potential. We may yet have to have a crisis before we can have an evolution of a new economic system. In fact, that is exactly how it happened in the last two occasions. So that is something that we do need to be aware of. I do think that there's value in the stock market right now. I think that gold is an obvious asset class that is going to benefit from the current environment. I think cash flows are something that are going to be precious in this environment, and the potential for dividend growth is something that is also going to continue to be extremely important. And the gatekeepers of the digital world are also exhibiting relative strength, and that continues to represent a growth phenomenon. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.